we as men, I think, have to be careful with how we joke about those sorts of things and how we challenge other men.
Benjamin Watson on Focus on the Family Minute, sharing how you can love your family better as a dad.
But, you know, the wonderful book about love languages, and if you read that book or any other book about languages, you understand that every woman has kind of a different way she feels cared for and loved. As a man, as a father, it's your job to be a student of her.
Mm.
And, you know, for Kirsten, you know, the words of affirmation,
yeah,
telling her
that's Jean,
that she's done a great job, affirming her in what she's doing. Man, you are taking care of the house. If she's working outside of the house, you're doing a great job there. You know, being specific about those different things shows, with intentionality, shows that we care.
Hear more from Benjamin about what it means to be a great dad and husband when you visit familyminute.org.
Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story, brought to you by Frontier Floors and Window Coverings at 830 21st Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-7878 or online at frontierfloors.net.
Unquestionably, it was the fight of the century, yet it was only the first of many to come. The World Series of 1903, that was the first World Series in baseball history. A contest between the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Boston Red Sox. And you know what? For the first game in that historic first ever battle between the National League and the American League, the Red Sox manager sent to the pitcher's mound, of all people, Denton Tecumseh. And the record book now confirms that he was the losingest pitcher of all time. Why Boston decided to start him against Pittsburgh, well, that's something as significant as the World Series itself. You see, Denton Tecumseh's theory of baseball pitching was that a pitcher should let a batter hit the ball as often as possible. That way, Denton said, your arm won't get so tired. And it seemed in the first game of that first series, Denton's theory was working out, sort of. Pittsburgh's first two batters did get some wood on the ball. They did go down in order, but then almost literally the game was over. Because that second out was followed by a Pittsburgh triple, a single, a stolen base, an error, a double steal, resulting in a run. And the score after one inning was Pirates 4 and Red Sox zip. You got to hold him, Denton was told as he went to the mound in the top of the second. And he did his best. The first batter was Pittsburgh's Beaumont. Denton actually struck him out. Next batter, Clark, hit a single to right. But he got overconfident, tried to stretch it to a double. He was thrown out, two down. The third batter, Leach, flied out to right. So it appeared that Denton Tecumseh had turned things around. But then in the third inning, Pittsburgh's Bransfield blasted a triple off him. Then Sebring singled to right, scoring Bransfield. Now it's 5-0. The Boston pitcher's peril continued in the seventh, an RBI, and then a home run. Now the Red Sox were done. Oh, they did manage to squeeze out a couple of runs in their half of the seventh and one more in the bottom of the ninth. And yet the defeat of the Boston team, at the hands of a supposedly inferior National League club, the defeat, the ignominious defeat, was charged to Denton Tecumseh, who was to lose more games on major league mounds than any other player in baseball history. If you forget everything else I say about Denton Tecumseh today, I want you to remember two things. First, he was the losingest pitcher in all major league history. But then I want you to remember one thing more. Today's visit's going to give you a new perspective. When later this season, awards bearing his name will be passed out to the best pitchers in baseball. You see, not only did Denton lose more games than any other pitcher in history, a total of 313, he won more games as well, 511 of them. And it's this latter record for which the sports world hails him, a hurler who was actually 2-in-1, a hero and a bum, Denton Tecumseh Young, whom you know as Cy Young. And this year, when the Cy Young awards are passed out to the best of the best of the pitchers, you'll know the rest of the story.
You're listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM, and KPRL.com. Okinawa next on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL 99.3 FM.
In December 1941, Japan went to war with the United States by launching a surprise attack against the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor in the Hawaiian Islands. In the following months, the Japanese ruthlessly overran American and Allied possessions in the Far East and Pacific Ocean. Yet by the spring of 1945, the tide of war had turned. A seemingly unstoppable American military whirlwind was thundering across the Pacific Ocean towards the shores of the Japanese home islands, threatening total defeat. There was a lot to lose. Japan had never been defeated in over 1,000 years and believed itself mandated by heaven to be a great power. Failure was incomprehensible. Despite the desperation of their position, Japan's leaders resolved to stop the American colossus at the gates. On the rugged island backwater of Okinawa, many believed that the superior will of Japanese soldiers, sailors, and airmen would triumph over American materialism and save Japan. As the last major fight against the Americans, Okinawa was as costly and as savage as the Japanese had intended. Yet the outcome of the battle and its consequences for Japan were to be far more catastrophic than her leaders could ever have imagined. On the 20th of November, 1943, U.S. Marine and Army forces, under the strategic direction of Admiral Chester Nimitz, invaded the outermost point of the Japanese defensive perimeter in the Pacific. The invasion of the Gilbert Islands was the first of the big American amphibious assaults in the Pacific. The bloody fighting on Tarawa demonstrated the ability of new American naval, air, and ground forces to attack and overwhelm almost at will any part of the Japanese defense line. The invasion of the Gilberts was the opening blow in what became a relentless drive by U.S. forces across the Central Pacific. In January and February 1944, the Marshall Islands were secured. In June, American forces leapt forwards nearly 1,000 miles to secure Saipan, Tinian, and Guam in the Marianas. In the South Pacific, forces under General Douglas MacArthur completed the liberation of New Guinea. In October 1944, Nimitz and MacArthur's forces combined to begin the invasion of the Philippines with landings at Leyte Gulf. Once the initial objectives of this campaign were secured, Nimitz turned his attention to the final approaches to Japan. Formosa, now known as Taiwan, had been the intended objective of the next phase of the American advance, not Okinawa. A number of considerations led the Americans to cancel the Formosa invasion in preference for an attack against Okinawa and the Ryukyu Islands. Army and Navy planners began to realize that with no immediate prospect of troop reinforcements from the European war, existing Pacific theater forces were inadequate for invading such a large and well-defended island as Formosa. On occupying the Marianas in July 1944, U.S. planners realized these islands lacked adequate harbor and base facilities to support the immense naval and amphibious forces needed for the Formosa operation. Although it took time for commanders in the Pacific to convince Washington that the Formosa operation should be cancelled in favor of Okinawa, By early October, Nimitz had received orders to plan an invasion. Codenamed Iceberg, the invasion was scheduled for the 1st of March, 1945. Prior to launching Operation Iceberg, the tiny island of Iwo Jima was to be secured to protect the right flank and lines of communications of those forces involved. The Marines landed on Iwo Jima on the 19th of February. But the fanatical last stand of the 26,000-man garrison on this 8-square-mile island proved harder to overcome than anticipated. In the end, the 6 weeks of bloody fighting it took to secure the island, as well as delays in available shipping, prompted the invasion of Okinawa to be rescheduled for the 1st of April, 1945. Ominously, American casualties on Iwo Jima had totaled over 6,000 dead and 20,000 wounded. Only 1,000 Japanese, too wounded to commit suicide, had been captured. It seemed that despite their desperate situation, the Japanese will to resist was unbroken. Although the loss of Iwo Jima represented a major breach of the Japanese High Command's final inner defense zone for the home islands, it was only one part of a total collapse of Japan's strategic position across the Far East in the opening months of 1945. Japanese forces had been routed and driven from Burma by revitalized British Imperial forces. In the Philippines, only small and scattered Japanese resistance remained. In January 1945, US Navy carrier aircraft began regular large-scale strikes against targets in the Japanese home islands themselves. In March, P-51 Mustang fighter bombers from Iwo Jima joined this aerial assault. That same month, long-range B-29 Superfortress bombers, based in the Marianas, began devastating Japanese cities with incendiary attacks. At sea, American submarines and aircraft inflicted savage losses upon Japan's merchant navy. The imminent collapse of imports of raw materials threatened Japan's ability to continue the war by denying her the weapons to fight. Even more ominous were the resulting shortages in foodstuffs. Japan's leaders were acutely aware that by 1946, domestic food stocks would be exhausted. Faced with starvation, there was a very real possibility that the traditional social and political order of Japan would be turned upside down. In the face of this national collapse, Imperial General Headquarters in Tokyo believed that only a decisive victory on Japanese soil could save the nation. What they needed was time to organize their remaining resources for the final decisive battle. The forces on Okinawa would be sacrificed to win time to organize the defense of the home islands. Okinawa would decide more than just the fate of a single island. It would decide the fate of Japan, her culture, and her people.
Discover the past with exclusive military history documentaries and ad-free podcasts presented by world-renowned historians, all on History Hit. Watch them on your smart TV or on the go with your mobile device. Download the app now to watch everything, from the gripping story of the Band of Brothers to Operation Barbarossa and D-Day. Immerse yourself in the dramatic stories of this remarkable era by signing up via the link in the description.
In the struggle for Okinawa, the Americans relied upon a number of experienced naval and army officers. Many of these senior commanders had served in the hard campaigns of the early years of the war, when the Japanese had been in the ascendant. The overall planning and conduct of the Okinawa campaign was under the command of Admiral Chester Nimitz, commander of the United States Pacific Fleet and forces of the Pacific Ocean areas. After the devastation of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, Nimitz took control of a demoralized Pacific Fleet. This modest, outwardly relaxed man from the Texan Hill Country soon set about establishing his reputation as a humane, inspirational, and aggressive leader. Arriving at Pearl Harbor, Nimitz rejected demands for a witch hunt of the fleet's personnel. Instead, he chose to heal the fleet's wounds and restore morale by immediately taking the war to the Japanese. In early 1942, US carrier forces attacked targets in the Central Pacific and, most impressively, Tokyo. At the Coral Sea and Midway, the US Navy halted Japanese expansion in the Pacific. In just 6 months, the quiet admiral had put a shattered navy on the road to victory. A submariner by trade, who never qualified to fly or command carriers, Nimitz developed a sound understanding of the critical role of aviation in modern warfare. He fully supported the creation of the fast carrier groups that became the main attack force of the Pacific Fleet. By 1944, Nimitz's revitalized fleet boldly drove across the Pacific, inflicting crushing defeats on the Japanese combined fleet at the battles of the Philippine Sea and Leyte Gulf. Nimitz never commanded at sea during the war, preferring to devolve command to trusted subordinates. A sound judge of character, he had a talent for selecting the right man for a job. When questions were raised about a commander's performance in action, he chose to make his own inquiries rather than trust the opinions of others. Although he commanded far from the battlefronts, Chester Nimitz was not a cold-hearted commander. Acutely aware of the human dimension of war, he regularly visited frontline positions to talk to soldiers, sailors, and airmen. One of the most capable and trusted of Nimitz's subordinates was 59-year-old Vice Admiral Raymond Spruance. For the Okinawa campaign, Spruance was placed in overall command of the 5th Fleet and the Central Pacific Task Forces. An odd man, outwardly cold and something of a hypochondriac, Spruance had a reputation for cool and detailed thinking. Originally a surface ship commander, on the outbreak of war, he found himself thrown into the new concept of carrier warfare. He swiftly demonstrated his abilities, achieving great success. In June 1942, he commanded the American carrier force that defeated the Japanese at the Battle of Midway. He then served as Nimitz's chief of operations before returning to sea command in late 1943. He oversaw the invasions of the Gilbert, Marshall, and Mariana Island chains. But his failure to annihilate the Japanese fleet at the Battle of the Philippine Sea in June 1944 attracted bitter criticism. Faced with a complex situation, Spruance fought with masterly logic, destroying the entire Japanese fleet air support in one day. Though Spruance shunned emotion and bombast, by 1945, in private, he fretted and worried. In letters to his wife, he confessed to sleeping badly. The strain of almost 18 months of conducting or planning operations, punctuated by infrequent periods of home leave, was taking its toll on the austere master of detail. The driving force propelling Spruance's fleet for the Okinawa invasion were the fast carriers of Task Force 58, commanded by Vice Admiral Mark Mitcher. These two commanders from different parts of the Navy developed a close and harmonious relationship over the course of the war. It had not always been so. Unimpressed by Mitcher's poor handling of the carrier Hornet at Midway, Spruance strongly opposed Nimitz's decision to promote his colleague to commander of the new fast carrier force in late 1943. As the war progressed, however, Mitcher proved his critics wrong, winning even Spruance's admiration. Mitcher's aggressive, courageous, and carefully calculated tactics smashed the Japanese in the Central Pacific and at the Battle of the Philippine Sea. By 1945, the man nicknamed Bald Eagle for his beaky, wizened face and intense, watery blue eyes was the preeminent carrier commander of the Pacific War. Mitcher was a demanding battle commander. He instilled his carrier groups with an alert and keen edge, by insisting that they always operate as if battle were imminent. Despite his slavish attention to detail, Mitscher gave his carrier commanders extensive scope to use their initiative. Setting the highest standards for himself, he expected the same in others. The Bald Eagle was a commander who needed to feel the pulse of action at close quarters. In the end, the strain he placed on his slight body during the war killed him in 1947. He was just 60 years old. If Mitscher was Spruance's right-hand man, then equally inseparable from the US Navy's success was the less attractive figure of Vice Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner. Commander of the Joint Expeditionary Task Force, Turner was responsible for planning and conducting the initial amphibious assault landing on Okinawa. Having overseen most of the previous landings in the Central Pacific, Turner was a natural choice. Commanding the U.S. 10th Army during the Okinawa invasion was Lieutenant General Simon Bolivar Buckner. His subsequent conduct of the campaign generated strong criticism from contemporary Marine and Naval officers. Born in Kentucky in 1886, he passed out middle of his West Point class in 1908. His pre-war experience involved training as a pilot and two appointments at West Point, the last as Commandant of Cadets. In 1940, he was promoted to brigadier and sent to Alaska, where he was responsible for directing operations in the harsh conditions of the Aleutian Islands campaign. In May 1943, he was sent to Hawaii to organize the 10th Army. Keen to be seen by his men, Buckner regularly went forwards to observe the fighting. During one of these visits, on the 18th of June, he was killed. In 1954, he was posthumously promoted to full general. The Japanese commanders, who struggled to save Okinawa and Japan in 1945, were motivated by seemingly contradictory factors. They were professional officers, utterly devoted to the service of Emperor Hirohito. Imbued with the ancient samurai code of Bushido, many preferred death at their own hands to the disgrace of capture. They fought fanatically to save Japan. Yet all but the most deluded harbored no doubts about the eventual outcome of the battle for Okinawa and the war as a whole. In a sense, they fought because they understood nothing else. 58-year-old Lieutenant General Mitsuru Ushijima was given command of the 32nd Army on Okinawa in August 1944. In the early stages of the war, he had commanded troops in Burma. He then spent several years as head of the Japanese Military Academy before receiving his appointment on Okinawa. On taking up his post on Okinawa, Ushijima immediately set about preparing the island's defense and improving his troops' morale. His calm manner, integrity, and quiet confidence earned him the admiration of his subordinates. Second in command of the 32nd Army was Major General Isamu Cho. A hard-headed and aggressive officer, in the 1930s, Cho had been associated with extremist officers who advocated setting up a military dictatorship in the name of the emperor. Although arrested, he was soon released and his career prospered. As an officer in the Kwantung Army in Korea, Cho had been intimately involved in provoking war with China in the 1930s. He reportedly took a leading role in organizing the mass killing of over 250,000 Chinese civilians at Nanking in 1938. During the war, he held a number of staff appointments in China, Burma, and Malaya. He came to Okinawa from the Military Affairs Bureau of the War Department. One of the brightest staff officers produced by the Imperial Japanese Army was 42-year-old Colonel Hiromichi Yahara. In the 1930s, he spent 2 years as an exchange officer in America giving him a unique insight into the nature and strength of his future enemy. His modest but fiercely intellectual nature often brought him into conflict with more senior officers who wanted obedience, not questions, from their subordinates. Admiral Soemu Toyoda led the Imperial Japanese Navy to a series of overwhelming defeats at the Philippine Sea and off the Leyte Gulf. By 1945, he seemed to lose confidence in his decision-making. In a divided navy, opinions on Toyoda's abilities varied greatly. Some considered him a brilliant man, broken by insurmountable problems. His detractors thought him lacking in intelligence and ability. At Okinawa, however, he fatefully ordered the battleship Yamato to attack US shipping off the island in the knowledge that she was doomed. Even more reprehensible was the fact that in order to carry out the attack, 1 month's oil supply had to be requisitioned from the merchant navy at a time when Japan's people were desperate for imported food. Such callous decisions were spurred not by military realism, but Toyoda's belief that it would dishonor the Imperial Navy if a ship bearing Japan's ancient spiritual name was surrendered to the enemy. Toyoda's decision typifies the conceit of a navy that placed its own warped idea of honor above the needs of the people it was supposed to serve. The plan for Operation Iceberg was drawn up between September 1944 and February 1945. It was the most audacious and complex amphibious operation to be undertaken by US forces in the Pacific War. The basic aim was to seize Okinawa in order to develop bases there to support the future invasion of Japan. Iceberg's objectives were only achievable by accumulating vast numbers of men and resources. It required the complex cooperation of naval and amphibious forces from Nimitz's command, as well as close coordination with Army and Air Force units in neighboring theaters. Iceberg was to be the ultimate test of lessons learned by American forces during their advance across the Pacific. The invasion was directly controlled by Vice Admiral Spruance's Central Pacific Task Force. Spruance's plan of attack was initially conceived in four phases. Phase one was to be conducted by Vice Admiral Mitch's fast carriers of Task Force 58 and B-29 Superfortress heavy bombers of General LeMay's 21st Bomber Command. Attacks by these forces were intended to isolate Okinawa by neutralizing Japanese air power in the Ryukyu, Japanese home islands, and Formosa. Once this was completed, Mitch's fast carriers were to take station east of Okinawa and provide support to the other phases of Iceberg. Mitch was also responsible for eliminating any enemy surface threat. Joining American naval forces for the first time would be the British Pacific Fleet. Commanded by Vice Admiral Sir Bernard Rawlings, the British carriers of Task Force 57 were assigned to protect the left flank of the invasion by mounting strikes against Japanese air assets in the Sakishima Islands and Formosa. In Phase 2, Vice Admiral Turner's Joint Expeditionary Force was to support landings by the 24th Army and 3rd Amphibious Corps of Lieutenant General Simon Buckner's 10th Army. These forces were initially assigned to secure the Kezeshima and Kerama Group Islands west of Okinawa. The main landings would then take place on the Hagushi beaches along the center of Okinawa's west coast. The second phase would end with the securing of the southern part of the island. In phase three, the remainder of the island would be occupied along with the Eshima in and off the northwest coast. Iceberg was larger than any other operation of the Pacific War. 183,000 troops and 747,000 tons of supplies were loaded into over 430 assault vessels and landing ships at 11 different ports, from Seattle on the west coast of the United States to Leyte in the Philippines. A further 115,000 service troops would land once Okinawa was secured to begin developing port and base facilities and airfields. Including naval forces, by the end of the campaign, 548,000 personnel participated in the campaign. They were supported by 318 combat vessels and 1,139 auxiliary ships. During the campaign, 60 carriers were available to provide air cover. Of these, 26 were fleet and light, the remainder escort carriers. 18 battleships and over 200 destroyers were used. During operations between March and June 1945, Spruance's 5th Fleet consumed more fuel than Japan imported in 1944. From September 1943, the Ryukyu Islands assumed increasing importance in Japanese plans, although little was immediately done to develop their defences. When the loss of the Marianas in June 1944 made a thrust against the Ryukyus a real possibility, reinforcements for Lieutenant General Mitsuru Ushijima's 32nd Army began pouring in to defend these islands. Despite these initial measures, by January 1945, the Army and Navy were split over whether the decisive battle should be waged on Okinawa or the Japanese home islands. The Navy hoped to secure a victory off Japan and resolved to commit the bulk of its air power at Okinawa. In contrast, the Army was convinced that Japan was the best place to defeat the Americans. Accordingly, troops were steadily withdrawn from Okinawa and promised reinforcements never materialized. This inter-service quarrel gradually made it clear to Ushijima that his forces were going to be sacrificed. He abandoned his existing plans to defeat an American invasion at the shoreline. The new plan was based upon sound arguments from Colonel Hiromichi Yahara. Aware of the overwhelming firepower available to the Americans, Yahara decided to concentrate 32nd Army's main strength in the south around the ancient capital of Shuri. The 62nd Infantry Division would defend three lines in this area, while the 24th Infantry Division covered potential landing sites around Minatoga on the southeast coast. Each division would be used to reinforce the other, depending on the direction of the main US attack. Only elements of the 44th Independent Mixed Brigade and a few service troops were deployed in the center and north of Okinawa. These were ordered to harass and delay the Americans as best they could. Yahara intended to fight a long and bloody battle of attrition. Okinawa was riddled by steep escarpments and ravines. East-west limestone plateau and ridges formed natural and mutually supporting lines of defense. Natural caves and burial tombs were easily converted into strong underground positions, largely invulnerable to enemy air and artillery fire. To man these defenses, 32nd Army had 65,000 regular troops and 8,800 naval personnel. 20,000 residents had formed a militia. At Okinawa, America would be battered by the greatest concentration of artillery encountered by US forces in the Pacific War. By doggedly holding their fortified positions, the defenders of Okinawa would have to be blasted out position by position at a heavy cost in American lives. As the forces on Okinawa prepared to sacrifice themselves, Imperial General Headquarters prepared to implement its Tenichigo plan. This involved the concentration of Army and Navy aircraft on Formosa, Kyushu, and around Tokyo. With the Navy providing the bulk of these forces, Army air units were placed under direct control of the commander of the combined fleet, Admiral Toyoda. The dilemma confronting Toyoda was how to use these forces in the face of American quantitative and qualitative superiority. Although the battle for Okinawa was ultimately decided on land, the most original tactical and technological developments were in the air and at sea. By 1945, the quality of Japanese pilots had slumped. The Imperial Navy was all but irrelevant as a fighting force. As a result, the Japanese High Command decided on the widespread adoption of new forms of the kamikaze tactic. Suicide attacks were not new. Throughout the war, Japanese pilots had demonstrated their willingness to crash into Allied vessels. However, during the fighting off the Philippines in 1944, what had once been a random act of self-sacrifice was converted into a formal and lethal method of attack by the Imperial Navy. The reason for this was simple. The only way that the Japanese could replace their huge aircrew losses was to cut back training programs. By late 1944, Japanese pilots had an average of only 2 or 3 months training. Rival US Navy pilots had 2 years training, and often the chance to acquire combat experience in minor actions. The resulting quality gap meant that Japanese air formations were regularly annihilated in combat. To overcome the lack of training and Allied air defenses during the Battle for Leyte in 1944, Vice Admiral Onishi instructed his pilots to deliberately ram their planes into Allied warships. As Japan's situation deteriorated, by 1945, greater reliance was placed upon the use of what were now termed Special Attack Corps, or TOCO, to compensate for Japanese inferiority. Special attack units comprised 3 kamikazes, supported by an observer aircraft and a fighter. This tactical formation was intended to maximize success by delivering a coordinated attack. The kamikazes were armed with conventional bombs or torpedoes to increase their destructive power. To avoid errors in the attack, the bombs were already fused. As the weight of the payloads often made the aircraft less maneuverable and consequently more vulnerable to Allied fighter planes, sophisticated tactics were replaced by a fast sprint towards the target. During the approach to the target, special attack groups learned to confuse American radar operators by following returning US air groups closely enough to mingle with their radar echoes. They sent out false signals to mimic the transmitters on US aircraft that identified them as friends to shipborne radar. To further baffle enemy radar, the kamikazes approached erratically, constantly changing altitude in the hope of breaking contact. In the final assault, a number of planes would mass against a single ship, attacking from several directions in order to overwhelm its anti-aircraft defenses. Uniquely in the Okinawa campaign, Imperial General Headquarters decided to launch a series of special attack missions called Kikusui. These consisted of up to several hundred aircraft, supported by conventional attack aircraft. After seeing off any Allied fighters, the massed planes of the Kikusui would swoop on exposed Allied vessels, overwhelming them by sheer weight of numbers and will. To achieve maximum effect in these attacks, the Japanese developed a series of specialized weapons and deployed their most advanced warship. The Imperial Navy began to design a specialized aircraft to carry out kamikaze attacks. instead of relying on less devastating and more vulnerable conventional aircraft. The most radical design was that of Ensign Mitsuo Ota for a rocket-propelled attack plane. The result was the Yokosuka MXY-7 Oka, meaning cherry blossom. Built partly of wood, the Oka was carried underneath a G4M Betty medium bomber and released about 50 miles from the target. The pilot then held a fast glide at about 290 miles an hour. When the target was in sight, a rocket was ignited while the aircraft was pushed over into a steep dive for the last 30 seconds. Its 800-kilogram warhead would smash into the victim at over 400 miles per hour, causing massive damage. The critical weakness of the Oka was the slow and cumbersome parent aircraft needed to deliver it. On numerous occasions in the battle for Okinawa, US fighters intercepted the Okas during their approach, shredding them out of the skies. US pilots mockingly dubbed the plane Baka, meaning fool. By 1945, Allied action had reduced the Japanese submarine fleet to a shadow of its former self. To stem the tide of American naval power, the Navy diverted research and materials into more economical submersible weapons. The Kaiten, or Divine Fate, was developed by Lieutenants Hirohisi Kuroki and Sekio Nishina. It was based upon the highly effective Long Lance Type 93 oxygen-propelled shipborne torpedo. The pilot occupied a tiny cockpit equipped with a small periscope on top of the torpedo. Powered by a hydrogen peroxide engine, the Kaiten had an attack speed of 40 knots, delivering a 1.5-ton warhead. The short range of the weapon meant it had to be delivered strapped to the deck of a conventional seagoing submarine. This made launching the Kaiten a clumsy and risky affair. Having reached the target area, the parent submarine had to surface to enable the Kaiten pilots to board their boats. At a word from the pilots, the parent boat submerged, casting off the shackles holding the four Kaiten. Throughout this procedure, the parent submarine was exposed to detection and attack from radar-equipped enemy air and surface units. The Shinyo, known as Ocean Shaker, was a suicide attack motorboat. Made of plywood, the boats were about 18 feet long and powered by a six-cylinder Chevrolet car engine that gave them a top speed of about 20 knots. In one version, two depth charges, each weighing 264 pounds, were carried on a rack behind the pilot. The tactic was for three boats to attack simultaneously, each seeking a vital spot alongside the enemy vessel before releasing their charges astern. A five-second delay on the fuse was intended to give the vessel time to withdraw. In reality, however, the fragile boats stood little chance of surviving the blast waves. Consequently, pilots were promoted two grades and received preferential treatment. On completion of the attack, they received promotion to second lieutenant. Most of these promotions were posthumous. Another variant of the Shinyo was fitted with bow charges. This was a dedicated suicide weapon designed to be rammed at high speed into the side of an enemy vessel. There was a facility for locking the wheel during the final approach in case the pilot's courage failed at the last moment. Over 350 Shinyo boats were hidden around Okinawa. During the interwar years, the Japanese Navy tried to match the US Navy's growing strength. Battleships Yamato and Musashi. Their general design was approved in July 1936, and at 69,000 tons, they were nearly twice the size of any other battleship afloat. Despite their bulk, they were capable of an impressive 27 knots, and at the start of the war, their turning abilities were superior to any other capital ship. At the heart of their design were nine 18.1-inch guns, the most powerful guns ever placed aboard a battleship. The guns were housed in three turrets, each heavier than a destroyer. Each shell weighed 1.5 tons, and the designated rate of fire was over 1.5 rounds per minute. The Yamato class were also designed to absorb merciless punishment. Their armor was capable of withstanding hits from the most powerful torpedoes and from shells fired 20,000 meters away. Built under the strictest secrecy, the Yamato and Musashi entered service in 1941 and 42, respectively. Security surrounding the two ships was so effective that until the end of the war, Allied intelligence on their capabilities was minimal. Generally held in reserve, Yamato and Musashi saw relatively little action until the late stages of the war. Even then, they never engaged in the ship-to-ship gun duel they'd been designed to fight, as the carrier superseded the battleship as the standard of naval power. Central to the American fleet's combat power were aircraft carriers. The heavy and light carriers made up the main battle forces of Vice Admiral Mitcher's Task Force 58, often called the Fast Carrier Group because of the high speed of its capital ships. The mainstay of the Fast Carrier Group were the heavy or fleet carriers of the Essex class. Big and fast, these ships displaced over 27,000 tons and were capable of a maximum speed just in excess of 32 knots. The size and armament of the Essex carriers enabled them to withstand and inflict heavy punishment. By late 1944, kamikaze attacks prompted the US Navy to look at the defenses of its carriers. There was only one way to stop a kamikaze: total disintegration, and there were only 20 seconds to do so once it came within range of the ship's guns. The Americans strengthened the Essex's anti-aircraft defenses by adding more guns to create a literal wall of fire around the ship. Extra 40mm guns were fitted. They also counted 12 lethal 5-inch guns and over 60 smaller 20mm weapons amongst their armament. Great use was made of VT, or proximity fuses, installed in anti-aircraft shells. Before VT fuses were introduced, anti-aircraft fire required the shell to be delivered near the target, and its detonation by a timer fuse set to the right distance. The VT fuse made destroying enemy aircraft easier by deciding the distance from the target via electrical waves reflected off the surface of the target. The combination of radar, inexperienced Japanese aircrew, and their aircraft's lack of armor transformed the VT fuse into a lethal weapon against Japanese air attacks. Okinawa was the first time that British carrier forces had operated in the Western Pacific. The four fleet carriers of the British task force had several features that made them less vulnerable to serious damage from aerial attack than their American cousins. Designed to operate in the narrow seas of Europe in range of land-based aircraft, British carriers were shaped by passive defense. Steel decks and armored hangars gave their carriers greater strength, especially when under kamikaze attack. In contrast, the wooden decks of the American carriers were easily penetrated by kamikazes that exploded amongst the aircraft and combustible materials on the hangar deck below. Despite greater resilience to direct hits, British carriers inflicted far less damage than their American counterparts. Armored hangars reduced the number of aircraft that could be carried. This made it difficult to deploy strong fighter cover over the British fleet. In offensive operations, lack of numbers meant that enemy ground defenses could not be saturated. Consequently, during the Okinawa campaign, the British suffered proportionately higher rates of loss than American air groups. Central to improving the carrier's defences and protecting invasion shipping against kamikaze attacks was the quality of the fighter aircraft. The most impressive carrier-borne aircraft available during the Okinawa campaign was the Vought F-6F Corsair. Generally recognised as the finest fighter of the Second World War, development of the Corsair began as early as 1938. The first production model didn't make its initial flight until the 25th of June 1942. In order to enable the Combat Air Patrol, or CAP, to intercept kamikazes, a greater speed and rate of climb than the Hellcat was needed. With a top speed of 440 miles an hour, the Corsair was around 60 miles an hour faster than its rival. It also outclimbed the Hellcat by 800 feet per second. These superior characteristics were enhanced by a standard armament of 6 half-inch machine guns, and the Corsair's ability to double as a ground attack aircraft, carrying 2 1,000-pound bombs or 8 5-inch rockets. By mid-1943, with increasing production of fleet and light carriers, the number of available task groups rose dramatically. To coordinate these groups in late 1943, Admiral Nimitz formed the Fast Carrier Force. The Fast Carrier Force had a complement of just under 1,000 aircraft and comprised 4 task groups, operating in close proximity for better coordination. Allowing for ships away in dock, each group consisted of 2 fleet and 2 light carriers, with a battleship or heavy cruiser and several destroyers in support. Its strength was the high speed of its heavy ships. The battleships could keep station at 27 knots, while the carriers could maintain 30 knots for several hours. Supporting the Fast Carrier Force was an impressive logistic train. A fleet oiler and transport carrier group of 24 oilers provided fuel and replacement aircraft. Additional support came from the fleet train that for the Okinawa campaign consisted of 206 support ships. These included repair ships, floating dry docks, hospital ships, salvage vessels, ammunition, victualling and store ships. Two impressive features of operations in 1945 were first the ability to re-ammunition heavy ships at sea. Second, the rotation of air crews between sea operations and rest ashore. During the Okinawa campaign, these factors enabled the Fast Carrier Force to maintain a high level of combat effectiveness over 92 days of action without it ever having to return to port. No fleet in history has ever sustained combat operations for so long at such intensity, so far from its home shore. The ability of the fast carriers to provide timely and effective protection relied upon advance warning of enemy aircraft. This task was given to the destroyer radar pickets and fighter direction ships. 15 radar pickets were deployed to cover all points of the compass, 50 to 70 miles from the main fleet anchorage off western Okinawa. Picket ships were concentrated in the north and northwest, areas considered the most likely approaches for Japanese attacks. 6 headquarter ships and 19 fighter direction ships were responsible for processing reports from the radar pickets and sending appropriate numbers of fighter aircraft to meet the threats. The whole line of picket ships controlled 8 to 16 fighter aircraft that could be rapidly reinforced by more aircraft on the fast and escort carrier groups. Once the landings were successfully underway, it was planned to install 2 radar stations ashore to relieve the exposed pickets. Land-based fighter aircraft would also be available to support the combat air patrol. There was some difference of opinion amongst senior naval officers about the role of radar pickets. Vice Admiral Turner stressed that their primary duty was to report air raids, leaving destruction of enemy aircraft to the CAP and anti-aircraft fire. Turner's replacement in mid-May, Vice Admiral Hill, considered reporting secondary to the destruction of enemy aircraft and breaking up their formations. Despite this confusion, the radar pickets played a vital role in protecting the invasion fleet massed off Okinawa. Unfortunately, their exposed positions and lack of defensive firepower against multiple attacks meant that they suffered heavy losses. 5 were sunk, and 16 were damaged.
You're listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL 99.3 FM, past the Robles Atascadero.